thanks everybody, particularly for turning out on a day where I kept thinking, oh, we're going to be shut down just as SFU was. But here we are. So please help yourself to tea and coffee and stuff. I won't be offended if you're in and out. I know life is complicated. I just want to say a few words before I start the talk itself. I tend to stick fairly closely to my text because I tend to, as you will discover quite soon, wander off in tangents if I'm not anchored. But I just want to say that this book is part of an extended program of research on childhood disadvantage, the first of which saw sort of fruition in a book on the history of adoption in Canada, Finding Families, Finding Ourselves, which came out in 2006. And many of the issues that I confronted in that book are issues that I return to in this volume as well. But what I was very conscious of in Finding Families, Finding Ourselves was that adoption was in many, many ways a good news story. There are certainly bad elements of adoption, and one can find them without a great deal of difficulty. But in general, it is a more positive story than the story that we encounter in the whole experience of foster care. And so I very much came to the conclusion as I was working on adoption that there was a still much larger group of children who merited my attention, and that I needed to tell their story in a way that a historian tells a story, so that one gets a sense of these trends over time, and to see that, as many policymakers seem to suggest, oh, these are new problems, no wonder we can't get our heads around them. And what I wanted to suggest was that many of the problems that we encounter with foster kids, kids in need of support and assistance, are problems that we can see certainly in the 19th century, and if I were a medievalist, we could go back that far as well. So I saw this as really an intervention in many ways in policy debates about how we deal in Canada and elsewhere with disadvantaged children. This talk is a chapter in the book that's actually just come out as of January 1st. And so I just want to set it within the chapters themselves. I start off with a chapter, Claiming Kinship, which talks about our notions of kinship and how they have evolved over time in Canada and related communities, and suggests that kinship has often been a highly romanticized notion that presents real challenges both for birth parents and for adoptive and foster parents, and that we really need to unpack our sets of assumptions about kinship, in which women figure very, very centrally in terms of being the overwhelmingly responsible adults who are held responsible for good and bad outcomes. Then I wanted to talk about institutions and Canada's particular experience of institutions, from orphanages to asylums to industrial schools to residential schools. In general, institutions have a bad rap, and we think particularly of Indian residential schools or Native residential schools. I wanted to complicate that to suggest that we really do have to unpack particular experiences, and so that if we look at the Jewish orphanages in Canada, for example, they seem to be exemplars of what might be seen to be a good experience if one has to live in an institution. And if you look at the SOS villages, we have one in Surrey, for example, that they seem to be a better experience often than a highly individualized support system through foster care. So I wanted to complicate this. Beginning the search for best interest, these two chapters are on policy and suggest that the evolution of policy in Canada really depended on notions of normalcy, respectability, and reliance on certain classes and communities to take up responsibility for children who were swept into public care systems, largely, although never entirely, because of the poverty of their parents. Then I look at the three chapters. First of all, First Families and the Dilemma of Care, which looks at first families, birth families, what propels kids from their original parents into a public or indeed a private care system. And then the chapter that I'm going to be looking at today on negotiating surrogacy, the construction of foster parents, who are key to understanding what happens to disadvantaged children. And there is a highly, as with all of this, actually a highly gendered story to be told. And then finally, and just for the graduate students in the class, I want to end with the story, if not knee-level view of history, in other words, getting at the experience of those who are the objects of adult interest, I wanted to see how kids themselves remembered, reflected on, and resisted their experience in the foster care system from the 19th century to the present as it evolved, taking into account that race, class, and gender were all important in determining what resources people could bring to their response. Okay, so as I said, I'll largely read this. Now, foster parents stand in for the community at large. For many children and youth, they may be the closest to responsible and caring adults that they actually encounter. The transitive verb to foster invokes care, development, and growth, just those qualities that we, of course, know benefit all girls and boys. This remains the ideal. Its achievement is, however, various and sometimes uncertain. The work of foster mothers and fathers has unfolded in the context of social relations that make, of course, some groups and individuals more likely, acceptable, or able candidates for this work. It has been highly gendered and ideally required expressions of model maternity and paternity. Now, Canada's fostering adults have always negotiated an essentially border status. In modeling superior mothering or fathering, or in operating alongside experts, such as social workers, they confronted a recurring dilemma of authenticity. On the one hand, most have received money and been subject to state supervision for duties judged preferably voluntary and private. On the other, most have lacked formal credentials in child study, and protection and governments have rarely paid professional wages. As surrogates and amateurs in the work of raising children, they have always struggled to be treated as more than inferior mimics of real parents or real experts. Women stand, I would argue, at the center, and men to the side of both conundrums. Now, this lecture examines foster parenting in stages. First, it turns to the ways that class, race, and notions of respectability position certain groups as potential candidates. Secondly, it focuses on mothers, always the central symbolic and practical players in domestic dramas. And next, it considers fathers for whom cultural ideals of paternity have been much less demanding. Then it sums up the growing sense of crisis that we are in the midst of right now, but Canadians have been in the midst of for some time, as indeed have been Americans and the Brits and the Aussies as well. And ultimately, it turns to the fact that surrogates encounter the same contradiction, I would argue, the same sets of contradictions that have shipwrecked so many first parents, namely the recurring failure to sufficiently value caring labor. Okay, first, class and race construct respectability. Now, many foster parents have enjoyed children and youth, and we have to be very careful with foster parents because they often become the bugbears of the system, okay? So that if you see them turning up in newspaper pages, it's usually as monsters, or quite often as monsters. Now, some Canadian families fostered over generations, and the care of unrelated youngsters has been integral to many personal histories. Such commitment has offered one way of demonstrating responsible maturity. Governments and agencies always aim to recruit those who could successfully integrate charges into acceptable mainstream behaviors suitable for their class, race, and gender, and best productive of good citizenship. And in their turn, foster parents hope to secure their status as responsible adults. Now, class. Now, modern child welfare authorities occasionally considered middle-class rescuers, but they learned that their charges had little appeal for this group. Few middle-class candidates applied or persisted over the history of child welfare in the 19th and 20th centuries. In particular, women with good employment prospects or similarly fortunate spouses had options that always appeared more rewarding. Receptivity to domestic strangers, I think, also diminishes over the course of the 20th century, as an earlier culture that you see in the 19th century of what's known as household sharing gave way to a preference or greater preference for independence and privacy associated with modern capitalism. Now, the handful of middle-class foster parents who we do see over the years appear, however, I think, especially motivated by specific feelings of service. For some of them, religion proved a prime motivator. For example, in 1957, a couple from Richmond, British Columbia, celebrated in an article entitled Little Rock, Arkansas Could Learn a Lot, were typically inspired by their Baptist faith to welcome four colored sisters and their brother from the Children's Aid Society. Inspiration, however, could also be explicitly political, and you see this today as well. After World War I, or at World War II rather, one foster father, identified as a hippie and a rebel, adopted and fostered as part of his lifelong dedication, as he said, to helping troubled young people. Now, such religious and secular middle class candidates frequently emphasize their commitment to social betterment. Some also, however, simply confessed to enjoying children. Many women in particular anticipated fulfillment through their work in foster care. Such seems the case, for example, with Kingston resident Sharon Beck, who was Ontario's foster parent of the year for 2005. A former school teacher, married to another teacher, she fostered more than 200 children over 18 years, as well as adopting and rearing her own. As she explained, and I quote, "When my own children were getting older, I still wanted to be around babies." You certainly hear this regularly from foster parents. Authorities, however, have never been really convinced of the value of middle-class recruits in general. Many, particularly those before World War I and certainly before the 1960s, regularly feared lest youngsters be placed above their station because the kids are largely overwhelmingly coming from working class and more impoverished families, so that they would either be too readily turned into servants or they would be rendered unsettled at the contrast with their original wives. So thus, certain working class households, from the perspective of authorities, always promised a better fit. Child protection authorities, however, sharply distinguished between respectable and often breadwinner working class families and those they dubbed the dangerous classes. Now, the worthy stratum, the respectable working class, with its taken-for-granted stay-at-home mums, or wives, supplied the intended bedrock of fostering programs in the 19th and 20th centuries. These families were to discipline and to absorb the unfortunate offspring of the disreputable and the dangerous. Now, such hopes coincided, of course, with the needs of many Canadians. Working class economies survived always and do today on a patchwork of contributions. In both native and non-native households, adults were used to doubling up and making do with sacrifices in privacy. When they could, respectable working class households long preferred to keep mothers at home to reap returns in terms of health and comfort and productivity, and also to exemplify the respectability of their households and breadwinner ideals. As opportunities for domestic production declined in urban settings, even ill-paid fostering held attractions. Its appeal for country dwellers was much the same. The care of kin and unrelated youngsters has always, of course, been integrated into familial economies. But modern governments and agencies, through an unprecedented security of payment, meant much to fragile budgets that have always characterized working class life. So living proof, as it were, of the promise of making it, at least on a modern scale, respectable householders could be both judgmental and helpful in their encounter with kids. In the 1950s, for example, proud traditions of harboring unrelated youngsters of families down on their luck help explains the financial and moral support of the Ontario and District, the Oshawa and District Labor Council for Ontario's best known foster parent of the 1950s, who was Mum White, and her informally adopted charges. As the wife of a laborer, she appeared to the District Labor Council to embody the moral rectitude of working people who looked after their own. Now, although quantitative assessments of fostering households are rare, there is evidence as well, I think, of a recurring profile of these working class households. In 1948, for example, a social work study from the University of Toronto typically found a majority to be heterosexual couples aged between 25 and 55, most with less than high school education, with at least one child of their own, and with an annual household income of less than $2,500. Husbands were generally skilled or unskilled workers, and women were housewives. Most owned modest homes, a real sign of respectability, and requested children between 6 and 12, who were, in other words, old enough to be relatively independent without the challenge either of infancy or adolescence. The majority of these households also believed that youngsters were essential to normal homes. And what I really want to emphasize is that these working class households tend to be conservative, and certainly putting a great primacy on having children as evidence of normalcy and respectability. While the additional income clearly made a difference, these adults publicly emphasized companionship and the creation of normal families for themselves and indeed for their own offspring. Religion was also a key motivator in many, many, many working class households. Late 20th century BC foster parents were described regularly as solid, firm, and sensible citizens who aspired to follow, and I quote, their church's dealings, their church's teaching that they should help the less fortunate. Now, in the 1970s, however, a rather less positive portrait emerged in an investigation of Canadian family daycare. This characterized most female caregivers, both in daycare and because the study went broader than they had anticipated in looking at foster care, sort of off the table, as it were, that most female caregivers were handicapped by young children at home, poor English, a lack of wage alternatives, and chronic illness or injury. Many providers confessed that they didn't really like children, and commonplace difficulties emerged, even the case of a relatively well-off subject who was cited in the study. This woman had two school-aged children of her own, fostered another two under 10 years of age for the children's aid, and provided home care to nine more from five families. As the investigator concluded, and I quote, it takes a crowd of children in one home to produce a meager stab at a living wage, and that kind of overcrowding simply adds to the caregiver's problems and the children's. How can you make a villain out of a woman with health problems and low self-esteem who is trying to add a few dollars to her modest family income by taking out other people's children, end quote. Now, over the decades, certainly from the 1970s and somewhat earlier, maybe from the 1950s, fostering, I think, became less attractive for more securely established working class households. As most married women no longer worked solely at home, economic respectability for these working class families could be ensured without sacrificing privacy. Very, very important. And that the pool of foster parents, I think over time, although this is a large generalization, we certainly don't have the data to support it, but certainly my sense of this over time, and that the pool of foster parents becomes less sturdily respectable than it was in the 19th and early 20th century. Recruits seem to come more often from populations with particular investments in keeping women at home, so it becomes more conservative, I think, and in the service of children and husbands, or in saving particular communities of children, notably First Nations. Okay? Now, farm and rural households, this is a very, very condensed version of this chapter. So that's why I'm moving quickly from one place to another. Okay. Now, farm and rural households supplied one alternative to these respectable working class households. Despite continued rural immigration throughout the 20th century, of course, in 1920 is the first time that the majority of Canadians are urban dwellers, Canadians always have readily idealized rural settings. Not me, I have to say. In fact, the hemorrhage of farm offspring kept strangers in demand on farms for companionship and for labor. In comparison with city dwellers, too, women on hard-pressed family operations had fewer economic alternatives and less education with which to maximize income. Geography, of course, also meant less supervision from agencies. Much like the home children brought in from Great Britain, older youngsters were commonly preferred for farm homes and their chores. The tragic subject of Alice Obama-Sowen's documentary, and many of you have perhaps seen it, recommend it to you, Richard Cardinal's Cry from the Diary of a Métis Child from 1986, typically spent his short life helping Alberta's marginal rural economies. Now, at the end of the 20th century, jurisdictions such as Nova Scotia reported 81% rural placements. and this is surprising, of course, since Canada's own rural population dropped steadily to 23% by 1991. So candidates were dwindling, but even then, rural homes are a majority in many jurisdictions. What counters this in some respects is the fact that up-to-date authorities became increasingly uncertain that rural life really helped largely disadvantaged urban youth. Was this really the place for them? Now, difficulties in finding suitable adults worsened when hard-pressed agencies over the course of the 19th and 20th century sometimes allowed foster care to become a dumping ground for particularly unwanted children. Vancouver's 1927 survey of child welfare, for example, discovered bad practices damaging the reputation of all households. By the mid-20th century, recurring reports of brutal and lazy surrogates were in the name of all. Speaking in the 1960s, one blunt social worker addressed foster parents and said that in general they were in disrepute, since so many, as she said, were marginal members of the community who are too often economically unstable, socially disorganized, and emotionally disadvantaged, unquote. These, in other words, were far from the stalwart working class and rural citizens who were supposed to display their worthiness in assisting unrelated boys and girls. Okay, how does race figure in all of this? Now, foster parents from racial and cultural minorities have always been rare. Certain adults were not readily regarded as supplying guidance that would restore children. Early authorities assumed a common race racial logic which associated whiteness with the clean and the good, the pure and the pleasing. Agencies as well had few ties to minorities, and mutual suspicion impeded recruitment. That mismatch, however, was not generally regarded as a problem so long as Aboriginal, Black, Asian, and otherwise negatively racialized youngsters remained relatively unusual among state charges. Now, when their numbers rose sharply in the last half of the 20th century, and particularly as proportion of the population, Native and Black kids, authorities, however, increasingly sought culturally appropriate caregivers. Now, explanations for such patterns extend beyond agency prejudice, which is often what's emphasized. Many non-mainstream households struggled to survive and were already crowded with additional kin and are today. Even as authorities certainly remained uncertain of their qualifications, minorities also regarded child protection agencies as interference, as their work as interference or even theft. To be sure, a few representative figures do take up, and I take up the work of foster care, and I talk about this in the book. Canada's long-standing shortfall of Aboriginal foster parents then reflects the larger absence of diverse representation. Differences, however, have also been crucial. In many Native communities, mainstream agencies were especially suspect as tools of cultural genocide. And even when authorities aimed to help and did campaign actively for Native surrogates, as they did in British Columbia in the 1960s, recruitment was rarely easy. One BC study discovered, for example, that many Native people, like others in settler society, would only consider related children. And this is still a problem for Native agencies today. Okay, they don't want to take unrelated children. For many, helping their own kin already meant that they had little space and energy left for strangers. Foster care rates were also a deterrent, as they were in the society at large. Native counterparts of the mainstream middle class, and you have to see a middle class emerging, certainly in the 20th century in Native communities, may also, I think, there's evidence to suggest that they feared demands for additional caregiving lest their own prospects and the prospects for their children be derailed. They too were likely, of course, to have women employed full-time and to have invested more in privacy, as is typical of the modern trajectory. Now, these trajectories, like those in other communities, could create distance from the offspring of others, particularly those others who are seen in many ways not to have met the standards of their own communities. Most important, of course, however, of all disincentives was the poverty and the disarray attendant on colonialism. Now, when foster parents enrolled in increasing numbers with tribal and provincial agencies at the end of the 20th century, their motives were also familiar, nothing strange about them. Many appreciated additions to a limited income. Fostering was also one way to show social and political leadership and to model behaviors that demonstrated the worthiness of their community, and particularly the worthiness of indigenous traditions. Okay, respectability and conservatism. Now, recruitment efforts and interest in application always reflected prevailing assumptions about what constituted propriety or respectability. Foster parents have frequently appeared conservative, and they certainly do in my narrative often, or more traditionally minded with deep commitments to gendered domesticity. In the 1950s, Mum White of Bowmanville, Ontario, who I referred to earlier, was a self-righteous proponent of such opinion. This middle-aged factory worker's wife, who at one time or another took in some 80 children, including 5 of her own, bluntly, for example, blamed wage-earning mothers. She also vigorously opposed birth control and held, as she said, that men today are sissies because women have made them sissies. And this is how she accounted for these children who were shipwrecked. Regular church-going has also been common. In the 1980s, one study, for example, found that most surrogates were at least somewhat religious and many were very religious. A later Nova Scotia survey reported 89% of its sample engaged in church activities. This is not representative of the Canadian population. Evangelical sentiments occurred regularly, shoring up willingness to receive particularly challenging youngsters. Here, the sole entry in Paul McCosey's monumental Encyclopedia of Canada's Peoples to mention fostering specifically is notable. And as he points out, both Catholic and Protestant Dutch Canadians were described as committed to the family as the most important institution in society and child rearing as an honorable and rewarding task. Now, when they fostered, such Canadians often seek eager to confirm or to construct a family myth that defined men as the exclusive breadwinners and women as the full-time nurturers. These self-consciously worthy citizens prided themselves on their distinction from first parents, so they often had very little sympathy, and often do have very little sympathy for first parents. State payments were accepted as a proper, if inadequate, reward for critical social service that was particularly requested by their churches and religious faith. Now, traditional values often have disciplinary implications. Corporal punishment might have been increasingly out of fashion in liberal circles, but such Canadians often considered it a necessary part of achieving order. Recurring evidence of abuse suggests, too, that church-going never guaranteed benefits for children. And I got a bunch of examples of folks who are both leaders in their church circles or good churchgoers who are abusers as well. Closely related to pervasive conservatism as well was the assumption that children should contribute to their keep, much like working class and farm offspring in general, and of course the pauper apprentices in the past. This could lead readily to youngsters' exploitation. Surrogates might, on the other hand, be better off than the original families that they sought to replace, but many themselves have always dwelt just steps from disaster. The additional children required economic inputs, either in direct transfers of labor, a solution made increasingly difficult by requirements for schooling, or by cash for care. That calculation could result in abuse. Now, not surprisingly, and all the more so because of the commitment many women and men developed to youngsters, foster couples, notably mothers, regularly also found cooperation with natal kin difficult. And this has been true in the 19th century, true today. Despite recurring evidence that youngsters benefit from continued contact with their natural families, if only to be as instructive, many surrogates in foster care, as much like those in adoption, resisted contact. The early 20th century efforts of the Toronto's Infants Home to have foster and unwed mothers collaborate ran into just such reluctance. Many, like adopters who feared original families, these foster parents regularly argued that contact was upsetting and dangerous. Now, this reluctance to be involved with original families flew in the face of the fact that formally recognized kin care was emerging certainly after 45 and very much by the 1980s and the last decades of the 20th century to confirm the value of continuing relations. Birth communities gained as well, I think, new opportunity to assert their own respectability, and there are constant narratives of respectability, adult respectability in these discussions. Parents may have failed, but other kin, notably aunts and grandmothers, would not. Relatives, however, could always share in the odium that was always attached to original parents. This was especially likely for racial minorities. Grandmothers and aunts, the most common substitutes for mothers and fathers, might have much to offer, as they do indeed, but they were always have always been tainted by parental dereliction, because after all, they raised the people who failed, and sometimes by their own histories. Many shared the economic deprivation that undermined shared the economic deprivation that undermines parental care. Previous run-ins with child protection made some kin susceptible to negative assessment, even as they struggled to save the next generation. The situation was all the more difficult, of course, because relatives often faced conflicting loyalties to different generations, to their own children and to the next generation as well. When Native agencies took over child welfare beginning in the 1980s, they could be more understanding of these complications, but they encountered similar challenges, all the more difficult often in the context of political interference from elites in small communities. Now, recent Canadian studies show grandmothers in particular giving up jobs and compromising retirement. Hard-won late 20th century benefits, such as the child in the home of a relative and the guardian financial assistance programs, which often involve lower funding, because after all, families ought to do this, and less supervision, because families know how to do this, also reflect, of course, pervasive assumptions by governments, as well as Native and non-Native Canadians, that relatives should properly subsidize care. Celebration of kin readily ignored the fact that relatives often share the disadvantage of birth parents, and equally seriously, it readily sidestepped the harsh fact that blood relations stand center front in the history of abuse. Okay? At the start of the 21st century, repeated instances of child deaths in the hands of kin caused, of course, BC's advocate for child and youth to demand greater scrutiny of kin relations. Okay, real mothers. Now, parenting of every sort, of course, benefits from affection and material resources. For mothers, however, love and money have often been judged incompatible. A pervasive cult of true womanhood has always encouraged women of all classes to subsume themselves in service to children and to husbands. Affection was a rightful, even sufficient reward, but pecuniary considerations were seen to tarnish character and relations. This paradox always dogged foster mothers, just as it has female teachers, nurses, and social workers. How could womanhood's supposedly natural impulses be reconciled with a fair wage? A question that's never been answered. Now, except by feminist theorists, of course. Now, most foster mothers have viewed care as deeply contingent with their own sense of who they were as respectable gendered beings. While compensation has generally been essential, that necessity did not and has never meant a lack of commitment to children. Most women have taken pride in sheltering children who have been failed, who are presumed to have been failed by the less fortunate or the less competent, and such women trusted in their particular capacity for nurture. Champions, foster champions, compared their own dedication to that of other women and believed that they were more womanly than the women they replaced. This feeling of a special quality is also evoked in 1945 by a journalist who typically hailed an ideal trauma foster mother. In the words, there are some women who make careers out of writing or painting, some who choose secretarial work or become nurses or doctors, but in the case of Mrs. Rogers, the case study, and others like her, child care is the most important and satisfying job in life. Homemaking and motherhood is not something that merely happens, they deliberately seek it out as a career. At the end of the 20th century, a foster mother summed up her own sense of the work. I have lots of love to give, she said, and I love kids. I have been babysitting since I was 12, and I loved kids. It's hard on the nerves at times, but I love kids. So this refrain goes right through. It is a testament to their existence, to such sentiments, a native veteran of child protection. One wants to be cynical about, speaking as a mother myself of three, intermittently didn't love childcare at all. You want to be skeptical of this, but you have, for example, a native veteran of child protection remembering treatment that did reflect in her own mind that she was being looked after by someone who loved kids. And she said she was brought up as a grandmother or as a granddaughter in a household that was warm and loving, and that she remembered it and it affected her own child rearing subsequently. A 2006 study of a very large sample of Ontario foster parents, this is where I dish psychology, so if any of you are defenders or champions of psychology, please leave the room. These investigators in this large study also demonstrated a marked attention to class, although indicators of total income when they're looking at altruistic motives, with over 50% of their study earning below $49,000 a year and some 22,000 less than 29,000 are suggestive. They also ignored gender. It's really hard to know how you can ignore gender in foster care, although 80% of the respondents were mothers. They did, however, discover that the two most frequently endorsed reasons for fostering were wanting to provide loving parents to children and wanting to save children from harm. Another 21st century study of motivations for fostering parents, fostering youngsters, also in psychology at Western, similarly stressed personal, not financial, rewards. Once again, however, they made nothing of the fact that of these altruistic parents that they found, 86% of them were women. And mothers, again, in this study as the other one, were taken for granted as the prime and taken for granted agents of altruism. That altruism is particularly the character of women, but this is not questioned, it's just taken for granted. Now, many surrogates or their close relations have themselves, if we look at them, also been fostered. They're part of this generational commitment that you find. And they pledge to help others as they have been helped or to do better than they had been treated themselves. One woman recalling her own miserable childhood with children's aid societies in the 1930s, for example, set out to rescue girls in particular by fostering for the province of Ontario. Another, inspired by her own unhappy adoption and subsequent exploitation in the 1930s, 1940s, grew up to marry, produce two sons, and to work as a foster mother and daycare provider for 111 children. Her husband explained, and I quote, "She always wanted to make sure that kids were okay. She was a good woman." So in some families, what we see is successive female generations, presumably inspired with altruism, at least partly, who develop a strong domestic culture associated with taking children in need. And I think this group of, you know, over many generations is particularly worth study. These generational commitments, I think, always form the bedrock of fostering in Canada and indeed elsewhere in the world. Now, although couples were always preferred, faith in women's particular qualifications as well kept spinsters and widows on the rolls right across the country, especially for very young children or those in less demand. One divorcee remembered, for example, that as late as the 1960s, and I quote, "The only foster children single mothers were allowed to care for were mentally handicapped ones, since the belief was a single parent could not give a proper upbringing to a normal child," unquote. Since their marital situation resembled that of many first parents, of course, suspicions regarding married women were hardly surprising. Now, even as maternal enthusiasm supposedly supplied a critical inspiration for fostering, it also posed, of course, I think, special problems in dealing with first parents and with surviving youngsters. A Halifax single mother of four, herself with a long history of personal hardship, real heroine from my perspective, including the necessary consignment of her own children to an orphanage while she worked to retrieve them, typified the possibility for at least some foster mothers of inclusive sympathies. While welcoming young strangers for over 20 years into her own home, she also took in their mothers, and she took them under her wing and into her heart. For such women, there was no contradiction. They easily saw, or apparently readily saw, first mothers as suffering some of their own predicaments and were sympathetic. For many more women, I think, for a greater number of women, deep investments in their own mothering skills, however, and notions of respectability meant that they readily viewed birth parents as transgressing nature, either where they weren't real women, and perhaps God, since so many of them were religious. Now, most foster mothers valued experience as well over professional qualifications, not surprisingly, because they thought the care for children was part of what's an innate expression of femininity. They have been readily suspicious in general of young unmarried social workers and uncomfortable with external supervision. A substantial social divide, of course, complicated many interactions between foster parents and social workers. In the early 20th century, investigations of intelligence, cleanliness, and finances by Toronto's Infants Home typically upset applicants for foster care. Its experts, for example, doubted foster care's knowledge of modern child welfare practices. In 1948, a social work student also conveyed, I think, how social inferiors, as they were, might be assessed more as potential clients themselves than as co-workers. And she said, "The foster mother may say she wishes a child as a companion for one of her own, when she really means she cannot readily control her own youngster and would like to try with another one to prove she is not a failure as a mother. She may say she is fond of children and wants to get a child at home, when she's really in need of the extra financial support, and yet she does not want to go out to work." In other words, they don't think it's work. "She may say she needs the financial help, while really she's lonely and she wants to mold a child into her life to make up for some of the affections she's not getting from her husband." And Freudian stuff comes up more and more in the 30s and 40s. Now, while some foster mothers have always appreciated external assistance from social workers and others, foster parents in general have valued child care for its autonomy. And this, of course, this opportunity for autonomy contrasts sharply with the factory, clerical, service, or sales jobs otherwise available to women of the class of most foster parents. Yet even as they cherish managing on their own, they have been likely to be undermined. As one study of California's foster mothers suggests, the bureaucratic, regulatory, and supervisory nature of the foster care system positioned professional women as matriarchs, licensed to intervene in the domestic management of others who were ultimately judged less competent. Since foster mothers were, as well as an Australian study demonstrates, and my own research suggests as well, independent, resourceful women, they found inspections by social workers with the interference that meant in their lives and homes often very difficult to bear, and this helped to keep some of them out of foster care. Material recompense supplied other dilemmas for such women. Foster mothers always wrestled with the perception that payment made them less authentic. Recurring public sentiments that good mothers did not require money to perform natural functions undermined their claims. Once cash changed hands, their contribution to human relations, not unlike that of prostitutes, was often effectively regarded as contaminated. In 1919, a journalist summed up just such sentiments. The woman who boards babies for money may or may not be a good person to have them, but the woman who takes a baby out of sympathy and love is a pretty safe risk, unquote. Now, many foster mothers, nevertheless, have always demanded a fair treatment and reasonable financial recompense. As one said in the 1980s, we're not supposed to make money by being foster parents, but when it comes down to it, we're subsidizing foster children. And Canada, of course, was not the only nation where women increasingly, over the course of the 20th century and very much from the 1960s, increasingly declined to subsidize child protection. One observer of the late 20th century United States, for example, concluded that changes in employment patterns, which I talk about elsewhere, family composition, and other democratic shifts contributed to a decline of almost a third in the number of active foster parents between 1987 and 1991. The supply of maternal self-sacrifice, in other words, is clearly exhaustible. Now, co-starring fathers. Okay, now, child protection agency and scholars have devoted almost no attention to fathers. They are difficult to find and attract most notice as abusers. Illustrative of persisting disregard, of course, was the 1970s suggestion that most foster parents, foster families were matrilineal, and that fathers were the forgotten man in a world where foster mothers are basically women that like having children around, unquote. Men seem little more than ciphers, in other words, in a maternal project. Over the years, authorities never wavered and don't waver today in regarding women as pivotal. Good men's dedication to waged employment and to respectability allowed maternal vocation. These men served best by aiding and abetting the more central efforts of their wives. Paternal surrogates have also been likely to win applause, particularly likely to win applause, for their investment in recreational and vocational efforts with the children. Like the fathers of the community in post-war Canadian suburbs, identified by Robert Rutherdale, foster dads had an opportunity to affirm male respectability and leadership by supporting the children of lesser men. Payment, nevertheless, for them as well, raised questions of legitimacy. Conservative gender codes prevalent among foster families presumed that true men supported their families without dependence on female earnings or state assistance. Some men, however, have always resisted sidelining in these operations. In 1960s, a Toronto couple shared honors, for example, from the Catholic Children's Aid family, as foster father and foster mother of the year. And over the years, they had taken in 25 children, many of them handicapped, as well as raising their own. And what we see is an increasing recognition, at least symbolically, that fathers might be important. As gender roles slowly relaxed, some men grew restive when they were seen to be secondary. In 2004, a foster dad from Niagara Falls, Ontario, for example, publicly rejected suggestions that his charges grew up without the love and security of a dad. He proudly claimed joint responsibility for the 24 children they had raised. We are loving, committed, and a lot of children who passed through our home have wished to return. Ask the kids, he said, they'll tell you. Such assertions were part of a growing appreciation of the value for children and men alike of nurture. They remained, however, hard put, I would argue, however, to dent the preeminent reliance on women and the heightened fear of male pedophiles that characterized late 20th century Canada. Okay. What I want to say, and I'm just going to do this briefly without reading more than a bit of it, is that state foster programs have always relied on respectable communities and traditionally gendered roles to provide home care at the least possible cost. These presumptions, however, ran into real difficulties right really from the beginning. So in the 19th century, the assumption is that foster parents will do it for free. They quickly see that it won't. They start to introduce payment in the late 19th century. And even payment, even it slowly rises, is never sufficient to attract the candidates they want or enough of any candidates at all. And this crisis of inadequate number of applications comes to be a serious problem in the 1960s and 1970s, when we get unprecedented numbers of far more disadvantaged youngsters in general than we see in the 19th century. Because the most disadvantaged in the 19th and early 20th century, as Leslie knows, as perhaps some of you, the rest of you know as well, were routinely assigned to orphanages, asylums, reformatories, or residential schools, or ignored altogether. So they were segregated. By the end of the 20th century, as well, we see drug and alcohol addictions of parents sweeping more and more kids into care. As the gap as well between rich and poor Canadians deepened in the 1980s and beyond, the situation deteriorated further. Recurring restructuring of child protection in a desperate search for solutions and the growing pains of First Nations managed programs joined with systemic underfunding to deepen the crisis. In 2009, for example, Saskatchewan's child advocate heard from a foster mother that, "When I started 9 years ago, there were a few children with behavior problems. Now they are more severe. 8-year-olds pulling out their own hair, scratch themselves, and 5- and 6-year-olds who hurt themselves and chew their toenails until they bleed." And that report goes on in very much in that way. That report generated upset for a few weeks, but its bad news had been available, in fact, for some time. Parents also found themselves living very far from any semblance of normal parental life. Now, the response to all of this was various. On the first hand, there was an attempt to upgrade foster parents. And this occurs in a variety of ways. First of all, you get this award system. So the people are being nominated as their local, provincial, or even Canadian foster parent, foster mother, foster father of the year. And a lot of applause. It tends to be short term. It's highlighted for the moment. And these particular people are usually brought in to try and maximize recruitment campaigns. Okay, and they're really interesting because they do provide you with a very interesting portrait, again, of the changing nature of foster parents. All white in the beginning, all heterosexual in the beginning, all of this respectable, conservative, highly religious working class population at the beginning. And by the 1990s and into our own time, you're seeing a more diverse crew who are being recognized by these awards. Members of First Nations communities, women and men who may themselves have some visible disabilities of one kind or another, single mothers and lesbian women, although I've not seen any gay guys being recognized by these awards. In 1959, for example, Mrs. Ernest Whalen became the year's foster mother for the Toronto Catholic Children's Aid Society. Much publicity typically omitted her first name. She was a wife. Standing in the shadow of her breadwinner spouse, she epitomized respectable womanhood. For 18 years, 12 of them as a widow, she cared for close to 60 crown wards. In her 50s, this looks younger and younger to me, she lived with 9 plus the chum of one of them. She also counted 2 married daughters, 7 grandchildren, and over 100 foster grandchildren. She confessed to embarrassment at the award. "I love children," she said, "and they've been a great comfort to me. I feel guilty about accepting an award for doing something I like," unquote. This self-effacement is typical of award winners. Even public recognition, however, did not eliminate the fact that foster parents were junior and ultimately vulnerable partners with state agencies. Lynn Platts of Nanaimo, British Columbia, for example, received the Lieutenant Governor's Award for Foster Care since she cared for well over 200 children between 1972 until the 1990s, a very large number. But in 1997, her husband is charged with abuse and the children are removed. So even receiving this kind of award doesn't protect you if the charges were true, it also means that people who receive awards may well be abusive. Now, foster parent associations were the second way of trying to reorganize this employment. The foster parent associations always originate with the state agencies. They don't come from foster parents. They try and bring in foster parents as activists, but a very small proportion of people who are actually active in foster care become active in the foster parent associations. And these tend to be the ones who are most political. So very small numbers, in part because their lives are always already fully engaged with raising kids. Many of them don't feel comfortable in these settings. And what's interesting about the foster care associations, despite the fact that they are largely agents of the state and often subsidized by them, What happens in almost all foster care associations is they come in conflict with state agencies. Okay. So they end up speaking for resistance to the mandate that the children are, that the foster parents are being given, which is often seen to be increasingly overwhelming, particularly as foster parents see themselves dealing with children who are more and more damaged by the previous care. What we also see as well is an attempt to introduce therapeutic mechanisms into the foster care system. So there's an attempt beginning in the 1960s, seems to be flourishing with state support, significant amount of state support in the 70s, right up until Brian Mulroney becomes prime minister, and we see the onset of modern neoconservatism, is to bring foster parents in with additional subsidies, working closely with therapeutic clinical teams, psychiatrists, nurses, social workers, physiotherapists, and so on, to produce a much more profoundly professionalized notion of what it means to be a foster caregiver. Very few of these survive in the long term because the funding almost usually dries up fairly quickly. And there's always problems of recruitment because how do you reconcile this need that the children have legitimately for care and love that goes beyond 8 hours or 12 hours a day with this increasingly professionalized relationship? The assumption is this, that the professionalized relationship will be short term and that they can move into something else. But often that assumption isn't realized. Okay, in conclusion, foster parents have acted as substitutes, of course, for original families and as expressions of Canada's overall capacity to nurture the young. Not surprisingly, they represent a contradictory picture. On the one hand, commitment to the daunting task of nurturing injured girls and boys, and we have to see them, I think, as injured, has frequently been apparent. Many surrogates, of course, rescued children. And we have to remember this story as well. Such as the story, for example, of a young woman who first lost her grandmother in Guyana, only to be rejected and abused by her relations when she's sent to Canada. She attributed her hard-won sense, as she said, of strength and self-confidence to her foster parents, who above all treated her with respect. Some Native veterans of white fostering, such as film director Jill Cardinal, remembered similar kindness and support, even as he engaged in a search for his first mother. On the other hand, however, there's abundant evidence of insufficient emotional and material capacity. Conservative codes of propriety that enshrine racist, homophobic, classist, and sexist values can deeply injure, and they do. When kids are strangers or far from cultural ideals, relations are especially fragile. Now, Canada's overall failure to value caring labor, I think, is fundamental to this overall crisis. The recurring sentimentalization and devaluation of care has hobbled child protection in at least three direct ways. First, as indicated here, foster parents and surrogate households in general have received inadequate support. Second, birth mothers and fathers too face the same dilemma of inadequate support. And third, the social work profession, with its lower ranks overwhelmingly dominated by women, has been undermined and overtaxed. Now, in all three cases, women, of course, have been expected to bear the brunt of kin-keeping and domestic duties that others always honor more in theory than in practice. The prejudices of class and race help ensure that some foster and birth mothers are especially handicapped in Canada as elsewhere in the execution of society's caring work. And until, I would argue, caregiving is acknowledged as the proper responsibility of all citizens, it will remain, as political scientist S.F. Hughes, political scientist Ilona Hankivsky has said, women's perilous project, and ultimately, of course, a national tragedy, which is what I think we see in foster care and is confirmed by our experience in British Columbia. Okay, so as the first line in this book is, this is not a happy story, and it isn't. Okay, sorry to be rushed. But
Jillian had to leave, so I'm going to do the tidying up part of it. We have 2 minutes, Mickey.
Sorry.
Comments? Yep.
Thank you very much for the talk. I like it a lot. I was wondering, I mean, it's just an example because it's a documentary I watched like 1 year ago, which really struck me to the root of my feelings, mm-hmm. foster parents in America. And then they were, I think the first the child they had was a child problem, kind of withdrawn the child, the child. And they, the, well, they treat the child in such a way that the social services, I don't remember the city, and I just was, they start to put more children on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then because they say, well, we as a couple, I mean, we keep it independent from the children, but we tell them that they're happy to have two dads, and they were so, like, I just see one of them stays at home, and the other is working outside,
mm-hmm.
and they have children, they put like a kind of like intentionally, it was two from Asian descended children, two were black children, and one was a Latino child, but five in total. And they were so happy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just so happy, the children and the interaction and giving and everything, that they want to wonder what, that puts the concept of motherhood, like, but this is the caring and the recognition of person who made the document, of the great effort they are putting into those children.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
no, I mean, we see publicly now caring adults being recognized as lesbian and gay couples as well. And in some jurisdictions, not all, in the United States or in Canada,
mm-hmm.
They're allowed to foster kids. Now, the attention that we see today suggests this is new. In point of fact, I mean, in the 19th century, I can clearly see women who are, we would guess, lesbian, who are raising kids that are not kin, although they're often nieces and nephews. And one or two examples where I think that we've got men who are certainly not with women who are as friends raising children. So, you know, institutionally it's new. I don't think that it in fact is new. So there is a wider recognition that a variety of folks can parent and offer support to children. But you will see that almost invariably they get the children who are the most disadvantaged, the children who are either racialized or whose abilities are seen to not match those of the normal. So they get, in general, the most difficult children to raise. They don't often get additional resources, and they're right from the beginning seem to be suspect, because the assumption is that foster parents will stand in for the respectable households that they lacked from before. And by being homosexual, then you may be respectable, but you're on the margins, if you're on the margins of that, okay? So that they're always given, almost, I think always given, the greatest challenges in terms of raising kids. And they are always among the most suspect. And the fact that gay guys and lesbians have risen to that challenge so regularly is a remarkable testament to the desire to care. I mean, one of the problems when you're doing this work, of course, as I found, was that, you know, you want to be cynical about, you know, these, oh, I love children, I just love children, I just love children. There's constant refrain that goes, I mean, who loves every child? I mean, I find it difficult to believe. Right? But because we know this is about an investment in a particular ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be cynical about it. But it is also true, and we all know it from our own friends and maybe even for yourselves, that there's some people who are just really, it's hard, I don't want to say by nature, but are just really, really good with kids and who like being with them and feel deeply fulfilled by it. But we have, our foster care system has been relying on such a population, gay or straight, to respond to this challenge of injured kids. So I think we need another question. Hey, nice to see you.
I'm struck by the word foster and sort of what that implies, and I'm wondering if you can say something about the movement away from group homes,
yeah,
to foster parenting as a kind of a provision of temporary parenting and temporary homes for
mm-hmm.
the children, because it's also in short of adoption.
Yeah, you have to say that, you know, that group homes come in as a way for two things: to deal with when there are just so many kids they can't find individual foster couples or parents to deal with them.
So they're concurrent.
So they're concurrent, they're always concurrent, okay? And that sometimes it's very difficult, given the number of foster kids in individual, because if you get identified as a good foster parent, you will get overloaded with kids. So you might go into it thinking, I'm gonna take one or two kids, and because you're seen to be a good foster parent, you find yourself with 10, okay? And then all sorts of regulations come in to control that, but it doesn't control it. So often these things, oh, there's this on the one side, there's a group home, you know, with folks who have usually particular hours and shifts and stuff. But in point of fact, the Saskatchewan study shows this is because foster parents are being given respite care, okay? So respite care means that somebody will come in for 8 hours every second day. So they become not dissimilar to group homes. So you have to be very careful about, you know, situating. I mean, what I was quite conscious of when I was looking at is that, you know, we tend to say we got institutions over here, which group homes are kind of small example. And then we've got, you know, good, loving, individual, largely heterosexual foster parents over here. But in point of fact, those distinctions are really untidy. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the institutions are, when they start out, certainly in the 19th century, and a lot of them, as we go on, are really small. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of these, you know, great Victorian edifices
with hundreds.
But often they're inspired by a particular, and it is overwhelming, a particular woman's commitment to a particular group of kids. Mm-hmm. And so she'll take five or six, and she becomes it becomes an orphanage.
Right.
And then some of them, if they're seen to be successful or they get particular kinds of support, become enormous. But most of them, you know, and I don't know if you're following, probably are, but you're following efforts to track down, you know, ancestors and your own, and perhaps your own personal experience. They rise and fall, so they just disappear. Some of them have, you know, they live there 6 months, or some of them are 10 years, some of them are 50 years. But so those distinctions are not hard and fast by any stretch of the imagination. You know, and the assumption is with foster care right at the beginning, that these are kids who cannot be adopted, okay? They can't be adopted for two reasons. One, nobody wants them, either because they're teenagers, and speaking as mother previously teenage boys, I understand this. Or because their parents won't give up legal rights to them, okay? So that you've got, but also because they're lost track of. I mean, what's quite clear until very recently, and even now, is that child welfare has been overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And that children, you know, I'm always amazed as a historian that people come back and they think, oh, they're going to, you know, find their parents who were in such and such an orphanage or such and such a foster care. Those records are overwhelmingly gone, not adequate, because you think of yourself as a social worker. Do you want to spend time keeping records, or do you want to, if you're a good social worker, do you want to help kids? Destroyed, nobody valued them, or made up. Lots and lots of made up records. Because social workers are trying to get these kids accepted. So they won't report illegitimacy. They won't report the suspicion of a racialized ancestor. They won't report that the mother shows signs of mental illness. So the whole history, right from the beginning, for many of these kids, is fabricated. And less so fabricated today, but for any of you who have social workers as friends, or maybe social workers yourselves, you know, you're trying to get kids, I mean, social workers are overwhelmingly have good intentions. And that profession burns out faster than any other profession, because, it's terrible. So they try and present the kids, and if you follow the, right in the 1960s and 1970s, they're advertising foster kids. They try to present them, as we all do, in the most, if you have children, you know, you try to remember when you're presenting them to their grandparents or to friends, you try to present them in the most positive way, despite the fact they're, you know, going upstairs as one of my sons might say, fuck you, and I'm saying, fuck you to them too. I don't report that in general if I'm trying to get somebody to like it. And so you can see then we have this real contradiction between public presentation and the terrible need. When I get into the chapter on foster care, dear mom and dad, care as children. You can just see the need. It's why I'm not working on child welfare anymore. It is just heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking.
Maybe only one more question.
Sorry, I can go on and on.
Maybe if there is less choosing the right class so that kids don't get raised above their classes. Supposing that that is true, why are there not more people out of our class who are taking foster kids?
Because it's a terrible job.
Mm-hmm.
Because these children, raising children, as we know, is really, really hard work. And there are not always the rewards there that, I mean, people who start out with having babies, they look all cute and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You don't anticipate how much work it will be.
Mm-hmm.
And these children, for all the good intentions that I think most people bring to particularly small kids, it's incredibly hard work. And if you see, you know, the reports, that's why, you know, it's really easy to demonize foster parents, because they're the people we would be if we only got around to doing it, right? But it is, you're working with children who have every reason to hate adults. It is amazing that foster kids, so many of them are great and, you know, forceful and strong and who resist the demonization that happens to them as well. But they are often very, very challenging children to deal with. I mean, and we have alternatives. We have good jobs, many of us. We have educational opportunities. It's not surprising. It's not amazing that the respectable working class is, you know, increasingly fled unless inspired by religion.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, for the feminists, getting with this crew of foster parents is that we've got overwhelmingly very conservative values often, because it's the only thing that armors you in this work, or not the only thing. I mean, a political kind of commitment would also armor you, but I suspect religion is probably.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. That doesn't seem to translate it. Political, moral, your heartbreak,
mm-hmm.
you know, that doesn't seem to do it, whereas a conservative religious set of values would.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can speak more. I find it interesting the way the discourse is changing around gay and lesbian families.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I see most often deferred to is, well, queer teenagers who are kicked out of their houses need positive role models.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of the, well, it's okay for gay and lesbians to foster gay children for role models, but we don't know if we want to take the normal away from the normal.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that, what you've seen of that discourse, if it's shifting from when I first encountered it, that's where it's at.
No,
okay.
No. I think because gay and lesbian couples, they would have enormous difficulties in getting new babies.
Mm-hmm.
They're not many new babies. And usually, because of this, you know, compelling narrative that all of us, you know, we can, you know, those of us who can birth, we can all mother. So there's a lot of pressure on young women and women in general to keep their kids, even well beyond their capacity to look after them, and without supports to look after them.
Mm-hmm.
So that very, very few small babies, or babies in general in the foster care system. So they're coming into the system much more likely to have been faced. Not necessarily active abuse. Neglect is much, much, much more common than abuse. But just in overwhelmed circumstances, with all sorts of unmet physical and intellectual needs. Usually the kids that are identified as lesbian and gay, and thus suitable for lesbian and gay foster parents, are folks, are kids who have self-identified, rather than are being identified by the agency, because still the assumption is that many of them might grow out of it. It's, you know, so then foster parents who are gay and lesbian are then getting boys and girls who are likely have been treated badly. Okay, and so they're not just wrestling with the fact that they want to come out as gay and lesbian. They're wrestling with the fact that these kids have had tremendous economic and other kinds of disadvantages, and may also feel deeply, you know, uncertain and guilty about who they are. I mean, it's, I'm not surprised that anybody does it, honestly, because we all have this, you know, version, you know, the advertising that goes on about fostering, and it's about adoption. It's this lovely kid that's just waiting to be molded and cared for, and that they will understand. I mean, hell, you know, the kids that you give birth to rarely understand that you're making sacrifices and that you're doing a good job and that you're doing the best that you can given the circumstances. And then these kids have every reason to be just distrustful of adults, every reason in the world to be distrustful of adults. And especially when you have foster parents who are often very, very distrustful of the original parents, have failing to meet, you know, the challenge of parenting, the challenge of respectable working class, you know, communities, and so on and so forth. And the same thing happens in Native communities. They're not distinctive. Native communities, very suspicious
of Native foster parents who aren't good, who aren't embodying the best of Native communities and Native parenting. So, and then you have foster parents.
First of all, I think I'm pretty sure Nikki would just hang around a little bit to further discussion with people that obviously have a lot of real interest in your work. But let me, please join me in thanking.